Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms with me, Padraig Reedy, and my co-host Neil Denny. Each show features a guest from a world of ideas, science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights or the arts. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, always often polemical, but always interesting. And our guest this week is Stephen Law. I will hand over to Neil Denny to introduce Stephen.
Thanks, Padraig. Stephen Law is Senior Lecturer in Philosophy at Heythrop College, the University of London. He's also editor of Think, Philosophy for Everyone, a journal of the Royal Institute of Philosophy. Stephen's published numerous books on philosophy, including The Philosophy Gym, 25 Short Adventures in Thinking, and The Philosophy Files, and other books including The War for Children's Minds, A Defense of Liberal Values Against Religious and Moral Authoritarianism, and The Great Philosophers, The Lives and Ideas of History's Great Thinkers. Stephen is a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. He was previously a junior research fellow at the Queen's College, Oxford, and holds a BPhil and a DPhil degree in philosophy from the University of Oxford. He blogs at stephenlaw.org. He was recently appointed provost for the Centre of Inquiry, London. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And also recently, Stephen, you've just been awarded a prize, the Mindelheim Philosophy Prize. So congratulations, and please tell us what that is.
Well, it's a new prize. I mean, I hadn't heard of it before because it's only just come into existence. There's a town in Bavaria called Mindelheim, and they decided to introduce a prize for books which encourage young adults to think and question. And the jury is a group of 17 and 18 year olds from their local school, and they've been through a lot of books, and luckily my book is the first winner, so I get to go to Bavaria in May to receive my prize, which I'm looking forward to. I also get to see the castle that featured in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which I've always wanted to see.
Is that Neuschwanstein?
It's the big fairy tale.
Is that it? I'm sorry, I've actually never seen Chitty Bang Bang. Is that odd?
So let's talk about the Centre for Inquiry, first of all. There's an American Centre for Inquiry which has existed for a number of years, and they've just set up a branch in London, which, as we just said, Stephen was appointed the provost of in July 2008. So, Stephen, what is the Centre for Inquiry?
Well, the UK Centre for Inquiry is an independent organisation. We've got our own sort of unique mission statement. We're partly funded by the American Centre for Inquiry. I should stress, it's a bit confusing that the American Centre of Inquiry is spelt C-E-N-T-E-R, and we're spelt the British spelling, C-E-N-T-R-E. So if anyone wants to look up Centre for Inquiry in the UK, make sure you use the British spelling, because you'll be sent to America otherwise. Our aim really is threefold. We want to apply science and reason to questions regarding religion and the supernatural, so questions about the divine, parapsychological questions and so on. We want to apply science and reason to pressing contemporary ethical dilemmas and social and political problems, so things like stem cell research and global warming. And then we also look at the question of what is and isn't good science. We look at flaky science and pseudoscience, so things like intelligent design, cold fusion, magnet therapy, those kind of topics are looked at. And we're putting on talks and debates, some in London, some at the Oxford Literary Festival, and there will be other events around the country where we get leading figures to talk about these topics in hopefully a very entertaining and accessible way.
Well, I want to... look at a little closer at the sort of points which you've said are the focus of CFI. But let's first of all talk about the next one of those events. There's an event next Saturday, is it the 21st of March?
That's right, yes. We've got an event called God in the Lab. I don't know if you looked at, I think it was February's New Scientist, their cover story was on religious belief and whether we are born believers. And there's a lot of research being done in that area now. I've got four leading researchers, three from Oxford University, who work on religious belief, who are going to present their findings in a very accessible and, I think, exciting way. I've got Emma Cohen, who works on spirit possession witchcraft and sorcery and afterlife beliefs, who's an anthropologist. And then I've got Mike Jackson, who is looking at parallels between religious experience and psychotic disorders. I've got Justin Barrett, who believes he has evidence that children are hardwired to be religious believers. And I've got Miguel Farias, who's looking at the effects of religious belief and whether it can help alleviate pain. So he's been doing some research on that. So this should be a very exciting day, I hope.
Where is this taking place?
It's taking place at Conway Hall in central London, which is very close to the Holborn Tube station. Red Lion Square is where Conway Hall is, and it's just around the corner from Holborn Tube. And you can find details about the event and about the speakers on the CFI website, which is www.cfiuk.org. And the address is there, and it's £10 for the whole day. And as I say, these should be really interesting, exciting, and above all, accessible talks with lots of bells and whistles and PowerPoint. And we even have some MRI scans of the brains of people who are hearing voices, I believe. So I'm particularly looking forward to seeing that.
Wow,
sounds great. Yeah. Stephen, do you think this it emerged in the past few years more of an appetite for rationalist and sceptical thought?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, it's hard to say. There certainly seems to be there are more forums for that kind of discussion than mm-hmm. there used to be. And it's an interesting question why that's so. I think it's partly down to the fact that religious influence has waned somewhat, and what religion is left has tended to be of a slightly more fundamentalist and extreme sort in some cases. It's become more noticeable. It's not, you know, your local vicar mouthing some platitudes, but it's really very outspoken people saying some sometimes really rather shocking and outrageous things. And so people have become much more aware of these kind of religious opinions and, of course, the effects that they can have on people's behaviour. And that worries them, some of us. It certainly worries me to a large extent. I think the fact that people like Richard Dawkins have stood up and have publicly criticised religious beliefs and said it's okay to criticise religious beliefs, we should, you know, we should respect people who are religious, but we don't have to bite our lips and hold our tongues and not say what we think. It's perfectly reasonable for us to give our opinions and explain our position and provide arguments. And so people feel that they can do that now, whereas I think maybe 10, 15 years ago, people were much more reticent, much more worried about causing offence.
Let's widen that out to scepticism in other areas then. I mean, the first point of CFI's aims, as you said, is the application of science and reason to questions regarding the supernatural, but taking into account their parapsychological questions rather than religion. I mean, why do you think people there's a trend, I suppose, to be interested in that sort of area as well?
It's a good question. I think it is connected with the religion thing. I think people are just interested in why people believe weird things. And one of the reasons why they're now interested generally in that topic is that religion provides some spectacular examples of lots of people believing, in some cases, something very weird indeed. So I think that's part of the reason. But I don't think it's the whole reason. I don't know. I could make some guesses.
Yeah, let's do that. Well, I was going to say. Do you think ironically, it's the. I mean, we were just talking about the sort of rise of where we are now at this particular minute, the rise of a sort of fundamentalist religion again. But I mean, do you think this, the rise in beliefs in more sort of esoteric belief systems has been something to do with the decline of sort of mainstream religion in society?
Yeah, I think I was kind of suggesting that earlier, that although mainstream religion has declined, as it has declined, so what's left has tended to be perhaps rather more fundamentalist and more extreme. There's a kind of, I think Anthony Grayling suggested this, mm-hmm. that the ones that are left are increasingly finding themselves marginalised, and so they become rather more strident, rather more vociferous, and tend to hold their beliefs rather more enthusiastically, shall we say. So that might be one of the reasons why those kind of people seem to be more noticeable now, despite the fact that, so we're told, religious belief is still, generally speaking, on the wane.
You've just written a commentary on your blog about a piece that the philosopher Roger Scruton wrote for the American Spectator, where he is basically sort of having a go at what he loosely terms a new humanist movement. And interestingly, I think you're absolutely right in when you say he's raising a couple of straw men there, but his sort of description of what he sees humanism as, or like an old style humanism about, the idea that moral values can exist in human beings without a sort of supernatural dictator sort of saying how you should behave, is basically what, organisations like the BHA are promoting anyway. And he's for some reason obfuscated that, and if he's misunderstood it or is deliberately aligning that. But interestingly, because that article appeared in the American Spectator, when you then read the comments that follow Roger Scruton's article, they are by, sort of fundamentalist Christians, which I would sort of hope would upset Roger Scruton as well in their sort of, there was one particular that really struck out to me where somebody said something along the lines of, what's the point of worrying about morality if you don't believe in God? Without God, and he's basically admitting that without the fear of God, he would be out raping and pillaging, I presume.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't.
No.
Yeah, I think I have a rather more elevated opinion of him than he does, because I'm sure he wouldn't be doing that. But yes, there is this mantra-like line, isn't there, endlessly repeated in certain circles, that, if you take religion away, we'll be going to hell in a handbasket. We'll be undermining the very fabric, unravelling the fabric of Western civilization, and, before you know it, society would have fallen apart, and that's just the standard line for an awful lot of Americans. It's the first thing they say whenever you question religious belief. Is, well, but for goodness sake, even if it's not true, you've got to leave it in place because the consequences will be absolutely catastrophic. And what's interesting is that there really is so little evidence to support that view, and in fact an awful lot of evidence, good empirical evidence, that it's simply not true. It's a myth. But because it's a myth which becomes endlessly repeated and kind of sort of entrenched in people's thinking, it just doesn't occur to them to question it. I suppose it's a bit of a shock when somebody like me comes along and says, but why do you think that's true?
Having been very involved in the humanist movement in the past, you always come along this line of, well, Hitler was an atheist. or Stalin was an atheist, which are very glib and accepted remarks, which I've never and it's odd how these things come across. But there's also the element of which you alluded to. I think it was Lord Palmerston, or possibly English politics isn't great, but said that he was a buttress of the church, and he supported from the outside. In that a lot of people seem to be able to happily accept what they probably know deep down are false arguments because it props something up that they think is worthwhile. It seems a very intellectually dishonest position to me.
Yeah, it's... whether there are some people... there are two cases. There's the case where you're going out to deceive other people, and there's a sort of neo-popular, neo-conservative line in the United States where you if you talk to people in private, they'll say, I don't believe in God, but the fact is that without God, the common folk will quickly run into trouble. So we have to pretend, we have to put on this facade that there is a God, and parade around in our robes or whatever, and create the illusion for their benefit, even though we know that it's not true. Now that, if you genuinely believed, I suppose, that society would really fall apart without religion to sustain it, then I suppose there's an element of dishonesty there, but it's kind of understandable.
Mm-hmm.
However, I just don't believe that it is true. In fact, if you look at under the article you've just mentioned by Scruton, I posted a couple of things, mm-hmm. and one of the points I made is that there was a study by a guy called Paul looking at different nations, advanced democracies, looking at how religious people were in these different countries, and then looking at societal health, things like sexually transmitted disease, homicide rates, teenage pregnancy, and so on. And he concluded that, in fact, countries that are more religious are more likely to have very serious problems. And the country which stands head and shoulders above all of the others in terms of having very severe problems on a whole range of fronts is, of course, the United States of America, where 98% of people believe in God. So immediately we have some evidence there that the idea that religion is the cure-all, we just need more religion, if only people would be more religious, society's problems would be solved. Immediately we have good grounds for supposing that that's not true, right there. And then if you look around the world, at the history of civilizations from ancient Rome and ancient Greece through great civilizations of Asia up to modern day Asia, you'll find that there's more or less the same morality, mm-hmm. but without any religion at all. Or if there is a religion, the religion plays very little role so far as the moral code is concerned. So you just need to look away from the United States for 5 minutes to realize that there's just tons and tons of evidence that civilizations can flourish and can be highly, great civilizations, great moralities can endure without the crutch of religion. It is just a myth that you need religion in order to have these things.
But would it be possible to say that religious belief in and of itself, belief in supernatural and an afterlife and a divine overseer, and can that in itself be a morally neutral position, neither good nor bad?
Well, yes, I certainly don't want to tar all religious people with the same brush. I mean, obviously I've been talking about some people who are fairly nutty in their religious beliefs, and there are many such people. But of course there's people who have a religious faith which is very benign, and in fact it can have a positive effect on people's lives. I tend to view religion as catalyst, which you can add to things, and it kind of gives them some extra oomph, some extra mm-hmm. power. So if you take good attributes like charity and compassion and you add an element of religion, you can often get people to be far more compassionate, far more active, far more motivated to do good. And people who are religious will point to that and they'll say, look at how effective, look at what a force for good religion is. But if you take a little dollop of religion and add it to some bad things, it makes those bad things much, much worse. So, for example, if you take a rather flaky character, a second-hand car salesman, and rub a little bit of religious snake oil on him, suddenly you've got a very seriously dangerous person who has the ability now to act like a Pied Piper and manipulate people and lead them down potentially some very dangerous paths. Take a corrupt regime and give it a religious underpinning and the robes of religious respectability, and suddenly it's a far more dangerous regime than it was before. So I think that religion probably is a force for good, and it's a force for evil. I don't buy into this. It's only a force for evil line, which has been peddled by some, famously. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to remember that while it clearly can be a force for good, it certainly is a very powerful, potentially a very powerful and dangerous thing. And so we need to treat it with great care, a bit like, say, nuclear power.
I'm glad that you brought up nuclear power, because I want to talk about the third aspect of CFI's mission, which is to look at the promotion of what is and what isn't good science. Although the example, we are going to stay on the religion topic, because the example I want to talk about is intelligent design.
Yeah.
Could you share with us your example of a sort of parallel theory to intelligent design, which is about the dogs from Venus.
Well, that was actually that one. That analogy is really. I'm really focusing on young Earth creationism.
Mm-hmm.
But you might be able to adapt it for intelligent
design. Well, okay. Well, let's talk about young Earth creationism.
So, you know, young Earth creationists believe that the entire universe is around about 6,000 years old, mm-hmm. and that all species were created as described in Genesis, and that no new species has ever evolved. And that's an insane thing, really, for anyone to believe, given what science has now discovered. But people don't see that it's insane, and that's very baffling. And I have, developed this analogy. one of the reasons I think why people who believe in young Earth creationism think that their theory is rational and reasonable is that there's in a way it can be made to fit the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
If you say, but what about the fossil record? What about all these fossils that we're finding buried under the ground? Well, they've got a very, complicated and carefully worked out theory to account for the fossil record based on the biblical flood. There are all sorts of maneuvers which they have developed, which very intelligent people at places like, I think it's called the Institute for Creation Science in the United States, which is a multi-million-dollar funded institution, all sorts of very ingenious explanations have been developed to show how young Earth creationism is consistent with the available empirical evidence. And people think that if you can show your theory is consistent with the evidence, then it's good science. And that's not true. I think that's one of the biggest confusions that currently we need to nail. There's more to a theory being good science than just being made to fit the evidence. And my analogy is, if I say I believe dogs are spies from the planet Venus, you would no doubt think that I lost my marbles. And you would quickly point to all sorts of evidence against my theory. You'd say, well, dogs can't talk. I would say, no, they can talk. They just choose to keep their linguistic abilities hidden from us. And you might say, but their brains are too small, for them to be intelligent enough to do this. And I'd say their brains are made out of special material, which is far far beyond our understanding, and they really are far more intelligent than us. We just aren't able to detect that. And you might say, but there's no evidence of life on Venus. And I say the dogs live in deep underground bunkers and use transmitters transmitting in a frequency or in a medium that we have not yet to detect, and so on. So whatever evidence you wheel out against my theory that dogs are spies from the planet Venus, ultimately I can deal with it. I can explain it away, given a little bit of ingenuity. I can make my theory fit the evidence, no matter what evidence you may care to bring out. This is a well-known point in philosophy of science. The mere fact that you can make a theory consistent with the evidence does not make it supported by that evidence. It doesn't mean it's confirmed by that evidence. The kind of reasoning I'm engaging in here with my dogs are spies from the planet Venus example is actually characteristic of certain forms of mental illness. I mean, people who reason in that kind of way are very often sent off to an asylum or somewhere where they can receive some special treatment. This is exactly how young Earth creationists reason. They think they're being scientific, and they are confused, really, about what evidence is. They think that as long as they can make their theory fit the evidence, hey, it's just as scientific as any other theory. And that really is, I think, the myth we need to nail. It's not enough to wheel out the evidence against them, because they'll tie you up in knots very mm-hmm. quickly with all of their ingenious explanations. It's the way in which they're thinking which is really the problem, and which you really need to draw to their attention.
That's brilliant, Stephen. We're going to have to draw it to a close at that point. That's a great point to end on. So I'll just mention again that the 21st of March, next Saturday, is the God in the Lab event, which is at Conway Hall, which you can look up the Centre for Inquiry London's website, and you can see how to get tickets from there. And Stephen, thanks very much for speaking to us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much, Neil.